go.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Welcome to Scarlin Books and our attempt to represent George Orwell's 1942 poetry programme, Voice. We are going to recreate, as far as we can, the October 1942 broadcast of the poetry programme, Voice, which, as you'll discover, had a theme. As far as we're aware, George Orwell was the person, along with his colleagues on the Far Eastern Service of the BBC, who in effect invented the poetry magazine programme. As I'll tell you in a few moments, Orwell, while he was in the BBC, went on to show the intellectual level and academic level at which broadcasts could be made, in which he laid down the standards which would later become the third programme of the BBC, and in the 1960s, when it was inherited by his colleague Jenny Lee, who became the minister of, who became a government minister under Harold Wilson, led to the ultimate foundation of the Open University. George Orwell began working at the BBC in August 1941. He left in November 1943. Voice, the poetry magazine programme, began in August 1942 and ran for 6 monthly episodes. It included, as you'll hear from our attempts, some of the major poets and figures of the day, including people like Herbert Reed, E.M. Forster, T.S. Eliot. What actually happened after Voice ended is that Orwell continued to work with figures of that type, but what had begun to happen is that they'd started to broadcast programmes matched to the syllabus of the University of Calcutta. They were aiming at the educated Indian audience. Before Orwell left, he'd moved on from broadcasting programmes about literature to a series dealing with science. Again, we can see the range of intellectual activity which then became manifest in the 1960s with the launch of the Open University. We're lucky in that we've got in today, November 2023, so that we can commemorate the publication of this book, Talking to India, edited by George Orwell and consisting of talks and other material by him and by many others, including E.M. Forster, which was published in November 1943. So, in fact, this month is the 80th anniversary of the publication of Talking to India. We are going to recreate something like George Orwell's Voice programme. Here's a photograph I'm holding up which shows some of the people he had working with him during a typical broadcast. In the broadcast that we're going to recreate, he had originally 6 performers or readers. We've reallocated some of those roles and reduced it to 4. Charlotte is going to take the part of the Indian novelist Mok Raj Anand, and you'll hear that Henry and Jill took 2 other roles, which will be named as we begin the production of the programme. I'm going to take the part of George Orwell, but I've reduced very much what he said, and it's been reattributed among our other speakers. Of the other 2 performers in Orwell's original broadcast, we've reallocated those roles among our speakers. So, after a short blast of music, which has a particular significance, which some of you may know,
this is London Calling. This is the 3rd number of Voice, our monthly radio magazine. And here is George Orwell introducing it.
Good evening, everybody. Much the same people are standing round the table as the last time, but we have two new contributors this month. One is Stephen Spender, whose poems are known to you, no doubt, and the other is Stevie Smith, author of A Good Time Was Had by All and other books. We found that this magazine goes better when all the contributions in it revolve around some central theme. Last month, you may remember that we had a number devoted to war poetry and war literature generally. This month, we have decided to have a number devoted to childhood. Not, of course, literature written for children, but about childhood. The trouble is that the volume of child literature is so enormous that one hardly knows where to start. Once again, I think we shall have to narrow the field by only discussing childhood in two or three of its aspects. What's the outstanding characteristic of childhood, I wonder?
Innocence, I suppose. We might start with something by Wordsworth. I suppose it's old-fashioned to say so, but I'm very fond of intimations of immortality in early childhood.
That's too long. Oh. What about starting with William Blake's poem, Holy Thursday? That gives you the feeling of the innocence of children, not perhaps what they really possess, but what an adult sees in them when he looks at them from the outside. Here it is, Holy Thursday. This is Stevie Smith reading it.
'Twas on a holy Thursday, their innocent faces clean, the children walking two and two in red and blue and green. Grey-headed beadles walked before with wands as white as snow, till into the high dome of Paul's they like Thames waters flow. Oh, what a multitude they seemed, these flowers of London town. Seated in companies they sit with radiance all their own. The hum of multitudes was there, but multitudes of lambs. Thousands of little boys and girls raising their innocent hands. Now like a mighty wind they raise to heaven the voice of song, or like harmonious thunderings the seats of heaven among. Beneath them sit the aged men, wise guardians of the poor. Then cherish pity, lest you drive an angel from your door.
It's very nice. But Blake is looking at the child from the outside. He is seeing the child as a picture representing innocence. There are many of his poems that succeed in doing that, but I don't remember one that tells you what the child itself actually feels.
Has any writer succeeded in doing that?
Yes, I think Blake does, because his own mind is childlike.
There's also cruelty in children. Nobody perhaps succeeds in conveying the actual feelings of the child, but there's a vast literature dealing with the adult's memories of childhood and doing it accurately enough to raise the same feelings in a reader. Any programme dealing with childhood which left out the nostalgic element would be incomplete, I think.
The trouble is there's so much to choose from. In a way, all books of childhood reminiscence are alike. The incidents may be different, but the essential atmosphere is the same.
It's the atmosphere of childhood. We must have at least one extract of that type. Spender, will you read us a bit out of the autobiography, The Innocent Eye?
All right.
Might we have one of Tagore's poems on childhood first? For instance, the one called First Jasmines?
And there's a poem of D.H. Lawrence which I have in mind. The Piano, it's called. As those are both short poems, I suggest we do it like this. We'll read them straight through, without any comment in between, and then the extract from Reed's book to follow. Well, here they are. First of all, Rabindranath Tagore's poem First Jasmines, read by Malk Raj Anand. Then D.H. Lawrence's The Piano, read by me. And then an extract from The Innocent Eye, read by Stephen Spender. Here they are, then.
First Jasmines. Ah, these jasmines, these white jasmines. I seem to remember the first day when I filled my hands with these jasmines, these white jasmines. I have loved the sunlight, the sky and the green earth. I have heard the liquid murmur of the river furrow, the darkness of midnight. Autumn sunsets have come to me at the bend of a road in a lonely waste, like a bride raising her veil to accept her lover. Yet my memory is still sweet with the first white jasmines that I held in my hands when I was a child. Many a glad day has come in my life, and I have laughed with merrymakers on festival nights. On grey mornings of rain, I have crooned many an idle song. I have worn round my neck the evening wreaths of baculas woven by the hands of love. Yet my heart is sweet with the memory of the first fresh jasmines that filled my hands when I was a child.
Piano. Softly in the dusk, a woman is singing to me, taking me back down the vista of years, till I see a child sitting under the piano in the boom of the tingling strings and pressing the small poised feet of a mother who smiles as she sings. In spite of myself, the insidious mastery of song betrays me back till the heart of me weeps to belong to the old Sunday evenings at home, with winter outside and hymns in the cosy parlour, the tinkling piano our guide. So now it is vain for the singer to burst into clamour with a great black piano appassionato. The glamour of childish days is upon me. My manhood is cast down in the flood of remembrance. I weep like a child for the past.
On the south side of the green were two familiar shrines, each with its sacred fire. The first was a saddle room, with its pungent clean smell of saddle soap. It was a small whitewashed room, hung with bright bits and stirrups and long leather reins. The saddles were in a loft above, reached by a ladder and trap door. In the middle was a small cylindrical stove, kept burning through the winter, and making a warm, friendly shelter where we could play undisturbed. Our chief joy was to make lead shot, or bullets as we called them, and for this purpose there existed a long-handled crucible and a mould. At what now seems to me an incredibly early age, we melted down the strips of lead we found in the windowsill and poured the sullen liquid into the small aperture of the mould, which was in the form of a pair of pincers, closed while the pouring was in progress. When opened, the gleaming silver bullets, about the size of a pea, fell out of the matrix and rolled away to cool on the stone floor. We used the bullets in our catapults, but the joy was in the making of them, and in the sight of their shining beauty. The blacksmith's shop was a still more magical shrine. The blacksmith came for a day, periodically, to shoe or reshoe the horses, to repair wagons, and make simple implements. In his dusky cave, the bellows roared. The fire was blown to a white intensity, and then suddenly the bellows shaft was released and the soft glowing iron drawn from the heart of the fire. Then clang, clang, clang on the anvil, the heavenly shower of ruby and golden sparks, and our precipitate flight to a place of safety. All around us, in dark cobwebbed corners, were heaps of old iron, discarded horseshoes, hoops and pipes. Under the window was a tank of water for slaking and tempering the hot iron, and this water possessed the miraculous property of curing warts. In these two shrines, I first experienced the joy of making things. Everywhere around me, the earth was stirring with growth, and the beasts were propagating their kind. But these wonders passed unobserved by my childish mind, unrecorded in memory. They depended on forces beyond our control, beyond my conception. But the fire was real, and so was the skill with which we shaped hard metals to our design and desires.
So far, we've taken a rather a romantic view of childhood. We've dealt with the innocence of childhood and the nostalgic feelings of the grown-up who looks back and remembers the time when he was a child. But childhood also has its pathetic side and also its nightmare side. A child lives a lot of its time in a very terrifying world, and even seen from the outside, a child is a very pathetic thing.
Once again, there's an enormous literature in the pathos and helplessness of children. But if you want something that gives that effect in a few lines, there's a poem by W.H. Davies called The Two Children.
I think that would go rather well with a short poem by Stevie Smith. Spender, perhaps you'd read that.
And what about something from Dickens? For instance, David Copperfield? Dickens knew that children, in spite of their innocence, can suffer torments even when they're not physically maltreated.
OK, well, I suggest we do it the same way as before. First of all, Stevie Smith's poem, read by her. Then W.H. Davis's poem, The Two Children, read by Stephen Spender. And then an extract from David Copperfield, read by Stevie Smith again. Here they are.
It was a cynical babe, lay in its mother's arms, born 2 months too soon, after many alarms. Why is its mother sad, weeping without a friend? Where is its father, say? He tarries in Ostend. It was a cynical babe. Reader, before you condemn, pause. It was a cynical babe, not without cause.
Ah, little boy, I see you have a wooden spade. Into this sand you dig, so deep for what? I said. There's more rich gold, said he, down under where I stand, than 20 elephants could move across the land. Ah, little girl with wool, what are you making now? Some stockings for a bird to keep his legs from snow. And there those children are, so happy, small and proud, the boy that digs his grave, the girl that knits her shroud.
Shall I ever forget those lessons? They were presided over nominally by my mother, but really by Mr. Murdstone and his sister, who were always present, and found them a favourable occasion for giving my mother lessons in that miscalled firmness which was the bane of both our lives. I believe I was kept at home for that purpose. I had been apt enough to learn and willing enough when my mother and I had lived alone together. I can faintly remember learning the alphabet at Terni. To this day, when I look upon the fat black letters in the primer, the puzzling novelty of their shapes, and the easy good nature of O and Q and S, seem to present themselves again before me as they used to do. But they recall no feeling of disgust or reluctance. On the contrary, I seem to have walked along a path of flowers as far as the crocodile book, and have been cheered by the gentleness of my mother's voice and manner all the way. But these solemn lessons which succeeded those, I remember as the death blow of my peace, and a grievous daily drudgery and misery. They were very long, very numerous, and very hard, perfectly unintelligible, some of them to me, and I was generally as much bewildered by them as I believe my poor mother was herself. Let me remember how it used to be, and bring one morning back again. I come into the second best parlour after breakfast with my books and an exercise book and a slate. My mother is ready for me at her writing desk, but not half so ready as Mr. Murdstone in his easy chair by the window, though he pretends to be reading a book, or Miss Murdstone sitting near my mother stringing steel beads. The very sight of these two has such an influence over me that I begin to feel the words I have been at infinite pains to get into my head all sliding away and going I don't know where. I wonder where they do go, by the by. I hand the first book to my mother. Perhaps it is a grammar, perhaps a history or geography. I take a last drowning look at the page as I give it into her hand and start off aloud at a racing pace while I have got it fresh. I trip over a word. Mr. Murdstone looks up. I trip over another word. Miss Murdstone looks up. I redden, tumble over half a dozen words and stop. I think my mother would show me the book if she dared, but she does not dare, and she says softly, "Oh, Davy, Davy." "Now, Clara," says Mr. Murdstone, "be firm with the boy. Don't say, 'Oh, Davy, Davy,' that's childish, childish. He knows his lesson or he does not know it. He does not know it," Miss Murdstone interposes awfully. "I am really afraid he does not," says my mother. "Then you see, Clara," returns Miss Murdstone. You should just give him the book back and make him know it. Yes, certainly, says my mother. That is what I intend to do, my dear Jane. Now, Davy, try once more and don't be stupid. I obey the first clause of the injunction by trying once more, but I'm not so successful with the second, for I am very stupid. I tumble down before I get to the old place, at a point where I was all right before, and stop to think. But I can't think about the lesson. I think of the number of yards of net in Miss Murdstone's cap, or of the price of Mr. Murdstone's dressing gown, or any such ridiculous problem that I have no business with and don't want to have anything at all to do with. Mr. Murdstone makes a movement of impatience, which I have been expecting for a long time. Miss Murdstone does the same. My mother glances submissively at them, shuts the book, and lays it by as an arrear to be worked out when my other tasks are done. There is a pile of these arrears very soon, and it swells like a rolling snowball. The bigger it gets, the more stupid I get. The case is so hopeless, and I feel that I am wallowing in such a bog of nonsense that I give up all idea of getting out and abandon myself to my fate. The despairing way in which my mother and I look at each other as I blunder on is truly melancholy. But the greatest effect in these miserable lessons is when my mother, thinking nobody is observing her, tries to give me the cue by the motion of her lips. At that instant, Miss Murdstone, who's lying in wait for nothing else all along, says in a deep, warning voice, "Clara!" My mother starts, colours and smiles faintly. Mr. Murdstone comes out of his chair, takes the book, throws it at me, or boxes my ears with it, and turns me out of the room by the shoulders. Even when the lessons are done, the worst is yet to happen in the shape of an appalling sum. This is invented for me, and delivered to me orally by Mr. Murdstone, and begins, "If I go into a cheesemonger's shop and buy 5,000 double Gloucester cheeses at 4d. each, present payment." At which I see Miss Murdstone, secretly overjoyed. I pore over these cheeses without any results or enlightenment until dinner time, when, having made a mulatto of myself by getting the dirt of the slate into the pores of my skin, I have a slice of bread to help me out with the cheeses, and I'm considered in disgrace for the rest of the evening. It seems to me at this distance of time as if my unfortunate studies generally took this course. I could have done very well if I had been without the Murdstones, but the influence of the Murdstones upon me was like the fascination of two snakes on a wretched young bird. Even when I did get through the morning with tolerable credit, there was not much gained but dinner, for Miss Murdstone never could endure to see me untasked, and if I rashly made any show of being unemployed, called her brother's attention to me by saying, "Clara, my dear, there's nothing like work. Give your boy an exercise." Which caused me to be clapped down to some new labour there and then. As to any recreation with other children of my age, I had very little of that, for the gloomy theology of the Murdstones made all children out to be a swarm of little vipers, and held that they contaminated one another. The natural result of this treatment, continued, I suppose, for some 6 months or more, was to make me sullen, dull and dogged. I was not made the less so by my sense of being daily more and more shut out and alienated from my mother. I believe I should have been almost stupefied, but for one circumstance. It was this. My father had left a small collection of books in a little room upstairs to which I had access, and which nobody else in our house ever troubled. From that blessed little room, Roderick Random, Peregrine Pickle, Humphrey Clinker, Tom Jones, the Vicar of Wakefield, Don Quixote, Gil Blas, and Robinson Crusoe came out, a glorious host to keep me company. They kept alive my fancy and my hope of something beyond that place and time. They and the Arabian Nights, and the tales of the genie and did me no harm, for whatever harm was in some of them was not there for me. I knew nothing of it. It is astonishing to me now how I found time in the midst of my porings and blunderings over heavier themes to read those books as I did. It is curious to me how I could ever have consoled myself under my small troubles by impersonating my favourite characters in them as I did, and by putting Mr. and Miss Murdstone into all the bad ones, which I did too. I have been Tom Jones for a week together. I have sustained my own idea of Roderick Random for a month at a stretch, I verily believe. I had a greedy relish for a few volumes of Voyages and Travels, I forget what now, that were on those shelves. And for days and days, I can remember to have gone about my region of our house, armed with the centrepiece out of an old set of boot tree, the perfect realisation of Captain Somebody of the Royal British Navy, in danger of being beset by savages, and resolved to sell his life at a great price. The captain never lost dignity from having his ears boxed with the Latin grammar. I did. But the captain was a captain and a hero, in despite of all the grammars of all the languages in the world, dead or alive.
The extract from David Copperfield is very good, but it's about a very peculiar way of treating children, not about normal child life. Conditions have changed now.
Yes, I suppose so. The essential thing in that passage is education as an instrument of torture. It probably isn't the same nowadays.
I doubt that very much. Children still run away from school, don't they?
At any rate, there isn't the Victorian theory that you have to break the child's spirit, as they used to call it.
No, but there are more subtle ways of ill-treating children. In Victorian times, they at least had the advantage of being neglected.
And there are still slums and malnutrition, not to mention bombs. Perhaps one can only say that the child's outlook is somewhat more hopeful nowadays.
I think that gives us the note to end on. I should like to end with Stephen Spender's poem, An Elementary School Classroom in a Slum. It tells the truth about actual conditions, and yet it's hopeful. Here it is. An Elementary School Classroom in a Slum, read by Stephen Spender himself.
Far, far from gusty waves, these children's faces, like rootless weeds, their hair torn round their pallor. The tall girl with her weighed down head, the paper-seeming boy with rat's eyes, the stunted, unlucky heir of twisted bones, reciting a father's gnarled disease. His lesson from his desk, at the back of the class, one unnoted, sweet and young. His eyes live in a dream of squirrel's game in tree room other than this. On sour cream walls, donations. Shakespeare's head, cloudless at dawn, a civilised dome riding all cities. Bell, flowery, Tyrolese valley. Open-handed map, awarding the world its world. And yet for these children, these windows, not this map, it's their world. Where all their future is painted with a fog, a narrow street sealed in with a lead sky, far, far from rivers, capes, and stars of words. Surely Shakespeare is wicked, the map a bad example, with ships and sun and love tempting them to steal, for lives that slyly turn in their cramped holes, from fog to endless night, on their slag heap, these children wear skins peeped through by bones and spectacles of steel, with mended glass like bottle bits on stones. All of their time and space a foggy slum, so blot their maps with slums as big as doom. Unless, governor, inspector, visitor, this map becomes their window, and these windows that shut upon their lives like catacombs break, oh, break open till they break the town and show the children to green fields and make their world run azure on gold sands and let their tongues run naked into books, the white and green leaves open history, theirs whose language is the sun.
Announcement. You're going to read the next one.
That is the end of the third number of Voice, our monthly radio magazine.
Thank you. Now, you may wonder, George Orwell died in January 1950, but his influence, as I say, lived on in the programmes and ideas that he produced. Far more ideas and far more ways than we probably think of. But equally, those poets who appeared with him continued to be significant, they continued to write, and I've asked my colleagues to give us each one poem by those poets of one of their better one of their best known poems, either from or from later in the period. So we're going to start with another poem by Rabindranath Tagore, which was read in the original programme by Malgar Anand, his Indian co-author. Okay, and this is Charlotte taking the part of Maharaj Anand, reading Rabindranath Tagore.
Letter writing. You gave me a gold-plated fountain pen, furniture and miscellaneous writing things, a dainty little escritoire made of walnut wood, personalised stationery of various sizes, a silver paper knife, enamelled, scissors, penknife, sealing wax, red ribbon, glass paperweight, coloured pencils, red, blue, green. You said at parting, I must write every other day. I sat down to write in the morning after an early bath, but I can't think of anything at all to write about. There's only one bit of news. You've gone away. You know that, of course. Still, it seems you aren't really aware. So I think I should let you know, you've gone away. Only each time I start to write, it becomes obvious this is no ordinary news. I'm no poet. I can't endow words with the timbre of my voice or the look in my eyes. The more I write, the more I tear up. 10 o'clock already, time for your nephew's school. Let me go and feed him. I'll just write one last time. You've gone away. The rest is only squiggles on blotting paper.
Thank you. And who's next? Okay.
In the 1930s, a new movement in poetry developed, the best known members of which were W.H. Auden, Louis McNeice, Cecil Day Lewis, and Stephen Spender. Collectively, they were sometimes called the Pylon Poets, a name which came from a poem called poem by Stephen Spender called The Pylons. This is it. The secret of these hills was stone, and cottages of that stone made, and crumbling roads that turned on sudden hidden villages. Now over these small hills they have built the concrete that trails black wire, pylons, those pillars, bare like nude giant girls that have no secret. The valley with its gilt and evening look, and the chestnut and the green chestnut of customary root, are mocked dry like the parched bed of a brook. But far above, and far as sight endures, like whips of anger with lightning's danger, there runs the quick perspective of the future. This dwarfs our emerald country by its trek, so tall with prophecy, dreaming of cities where often clouds shall lean their swan white neck.
Thank you. Stevie Smith.
I may read something in a newspaper that disturbs me rather, and makes me want to write about what I feel. For instance, I read about a man getting drowned once. His friends thought he was waving to them from the sea, but he was drowning. This often happens in swimming baths or at the seaside, and I thought, in a little way, it is true of life, too, that a lot of people pretend, out of bravery, really, that they are very jolly and ordinary sort of chaps, But really, they do not feel at home in the world or able to make friends easily. So then they joke a lot and laugh, and people think they are quite all right and jolly nice too. But sometimes the brave pretense breaks down, and then, like the man in this poem, they are lost. Not waving, but drowning. Nobody heard him, the dead man, but still he lay moaning. I was much further out than you thought, and not waving, but drowning. Poor chap, he always loved larking, and now he's dead. It must have been too cold for him, his heart gave way, they said. Oh, no, 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 it was too cold always, still the dead one lay moaning. I was much too far out all my life, and not waving, but drowning.
Today is November the 30th, which is St Andrew's Day, which is also the title of a poem that George Orwell wrote and liked so much that not only did he publish it in 1935, but he gave it to his character Gordon Comstock to write in the first chapter of his novel, Keep the Aspidistra Flying. Sharply the menacing wind sweeps over the bending poplars newly bare, and the dark ribbons of the chimneys veer downward, flicked by whips of air. Torn posters flutter, coldly sound the boom of trains and the rattle of hooves, and the clerks who hurry to the station look, shuddering over the eastern roofs, thinking each one, here comes the winter, please God I keep my job this year. And bleakly, as the cold strikes through their entrails like an icy spear, they think of rent, rates, season tickets, insurance, coal, the skivvies' wages, boots, school bills, and the next instalment upon the two twin beds from Drages. For if in careless summer days in groves of Ashtaroth we hoard, repentant now when winds blow cold, we kneel before our rightful Lord, the Lord of all, the money God, who rules us blood and hand and brain, who gives the roof that stops the wind, and giving takes away again, who marks with jealous, watchful care our thoughts, our dreams, our secret ways, who picks our words and cuts our clothes and maps the pattern of our days, who chills our anger, curbs our hope, and buys our lives and pays with toys, who claims as tribute broken faith, accepted insult, muted joys, who binds with chains the poet's wit, the navvy's strength, the soldier's pride, and lays the sleek estranging shield between the lover and his bride. And with that, we come to the end of our event. Thank you very much. But in order to give you your money's worth, oh, I'd like to thank Charlotte Lunn, Henry Fothergill, Jill Gosling,
and the wonderful Les Hurst.
But we now throw it open. If you have any comments, observations, then we'd love to hear what you think.
I'm afraid we've got scuttled.
It's done that to you, has it?
It's a physical comment. I've got babysitting.
Georgina dumped it on us 10 minutes before we were about to leave, so I apologise.